And now, welcome to Who's Talking with D.G. Martin. Who's Talking, featuring interesting guests from our community on News Talk 1360 WCATL. Now, here is D.G. Martin.
Welcome to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. A new book that's just been published by UNC Press, To Right These Wrongs, The North Carolina Fund and the Battle to End Poverty and Inequality in the 1960s America, a book by Duke professor Robert Corstead and Carolina professor James Lewittis, has reminded us about a great Chapel Hill person, George Esser, who passed away a couple of years ago. But before George died, he wrote a memoir, an oral history, My Years at the North Carolina Fund, 1963 to 1970, an oral history. And so while the new book has turned our attention back to the work of this great man, it's just made us, or made me, more curious about someone who lived among us and gained our respect, but who was in another venue a great hero. So I persuaded Rob Bickley, who was who wrote that book with George Esser, to come and visit with us and reminisce a little bit about George Esser. And Rob Bickley, thank you so much for taking time to visit with us.
Thank you, DG. I look forward to talking with you.
Well, it's been a while since you all wrote the book, and I would say it is it's available from Amazon as a book, and I think is at least portions of it are available online. Is
the whole thing's available online, I have to say, and you can order it from Amazon or look it up online. We published the book in 07. George had just passed away before that, so I'm so sorry he could not see it, but he did see the very, very final draft of it. So maybe he's looking down on us and listening in today, DG.
I'm sure he is. tell us a little bit about what you learned about George Esser as you all worked together, and what are your memories of him?
George Esser, when I met George, he was 84. He was living at Carol Woods in an assisted living facility with his wife, and at that point he was still walking around and doing fine. And George had one burning thing to do before he died, and that thing was to write down his memories of the North Carolina Fund. It had been the most important thing he'd ever done in his whole life, and he knew he'd made a big impression on the state and actually on the country with the North Carolina Fund. I met him on another assignment, and he said, I have this story I have to write down. And I said, well, maybe I can help you do that. So George was burning to tell this story.
You're of a different generation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
back two generations back.
That's right. I was in my 40s and George was 84.
And so what did you start out? I mean, but you keep up with politics, and so you had heard of the North Carolina Fund, but did you know anything about it? Did you know that history?
I really did not know much about it at all. I had only heard it in the most oblique way. And I certainly didn't know the stuff that I learned when I did the book with George. It is a thing that most folks don't know about today, and I'm so happy that the Lewittis Corstead book is out to tell the world about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll celebrate that. And mm-hmm. the accompanying video, George would have
yes.
I think, been proud of that. I would say, I mean, in that George and you having put together the memoir made it easier for them to tell that story correctly.
I hope so. George was actually monitoring the copies of their book and the drafts they were producing and reading those drafts. And he told me to tell Jim that he had gotten it exactly right.
Oh, that's great.
Isn't that great?
Well, what did you, let's try to approach it this way. When you all sat down, and one of the things, I'm sure you did a little studying and background on the Carolina Fund, but when George sat you down to start your conversations about his memoir, what did he tell you first to bring, to bring you up to date?
And the first thing George said, George walked me over to his study, and on the wall of his study was a framed picture that Billy Barnes took for the fund, and it's a picture of Howard Fuller, who was the iconic community organizer in Durham. Howard Fuller is leading a march of black folks downtown to City Hall to complain about and to demand that they be given good housing and good jobs. And Howard is this young, strong man. Behind him is another black fellow with an armband on who was making sure that there was no trouble. George looked at that picture and he said he clenched his fist and he said to me, he pointed to that picture, his curled over old back, he said to me, Durham never burned. Because Howard Fuller and his group, and with our backing, was having the citizens do principled, systematic protest. They went through the system to protest, and unlike Watts or anywhere else, Durham never burned. He was so proud of that. That's how he got me into the whole story.
That was the introduction. Yep, Durham never burned.
Durham never burned.
Now, this is a complicated headline.
Things that didn't happen aren't so easy to put into headlines, are they?
Yeah, well, it really is, because a lot of the headline for others in Durham, not taking account of what was going on in some of the American cities, would say that GD North Carolina Fund organized these people to march and disrupt our peaceful Durham
right.
situation.
Mm-hmm. And Durham was one of the trademarks of the fund. And George said Howard Fuller helped him realize that when there was a great big furor over black folks demanding their rights, that it wasn't the fault of the black folks making those demands. It was the fault of the city council, the county commissioners, whoever wasn't listening. That's who was creating the problem. And Howard Fuller really helped George evolve into somebody who was more passionately committed to the rights of the poor person and the poor black person to get those rights and to self-determination.
Is it fair to say that George Esser, who became the first director of the North Carolina Fund in the early 1960s, that in some respects he started out as a traditional, let's end poverty by bringing to the poor communities programs and resources?
Absolutely.
That we will show them how to get out of poverty. And then people like Howard Fuller taught him some things.
That's precisely right. George started out in this business as a technocrat. He was at the Institute of Government of UNC, and he taught city government officials how to do their jobs, city lawyers, etc. George had been grown up in an aristocratic Virginia family, had been in the Army, had had very little exposure to black folks except in the Army. And he started out believing that the problem with these poor people is that they don't have good enough access to government services. The fund should help them get better access to those services. Well, that's what he and the fund believed for a while, but then the scales soon fell from their eyes. And Howard Fuller helped them see that the white folks in power weren't going to budge unless they got confronted, unless the black folks had some real power. That's what they tried to do.
Why was George Esser selected to be the director of the North Carolina Fund?
Well, it had to do with a brilliant man named John Ely. John Ely, as you know, was working for Terry Sanford. Terry Sanford was the governor who started the whole North Carolina Fund as a way to make the state progress in the face of a conservative state legislature. And John Ely was Terry Sanford's idea man. And he got it all started with the Ford Foundation. But at that point, George Esser was a fellow not really related to this. He ended up writing a memo about how this should go. And he differed with his superiors, who were more into traditional city planning. John Ely liked George Esser's ideas. He said, you come over to the governor's mansion on Christmas Eve, 63. You come over and talk to the governor. You need to be there when the fund folks are there meeting with him. That's how George got into this, was John Ely saw that his ideas were the better ideas.
What were the ideas, and how are they different from other ideas that were circulating in 1963?
George was in touch with the Ford Foundation's thinking, and they were thinking about what they call gray areas, which is what we would call that today, slums or ghettos. And George was somehow thinking that what we need to do is go into communities where there are poor people and figure out what they want. And that wasn't at all the approach of traditional city planners, such as George's boss, who was nominally going to be, helping the Ford Foundation do this. They're more into traditional city planning, how you build things, where you put buildings, that kind of thing. George's idea was, let's go find the people, and what do they want? And that was just an inkling, really. And he developed his ideas much more, you know, with Howard Fuller and his other staff folks later on.
We're visiting with Rob Bickley, who was the co-author with George Esser of his memoir about his time with the North Carolina Fund. Ryan and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. My guest is Rob Bickley, who helped George Esser, Chapel Hill's George Esser, write his memoir, right before he died.
Right into his life.
And the title of the book is My Years at the North Carolina Fund, 1963 through 1970, in oral history. And Rye and I are reminiscing about George Esser, and we're doing it in the context of the publication of another book, brand new book, by UNC Press, To Right These Wrongs, by Robert Korstad and Jim Lalutis, one from Duke and one from Carolina, who have written an entire history of the North Carolina Fund in the 1960s. One of the things, Rye, that George took into account when he took the job was this was a time-limited job.
Yep.
You know, most entities that get started to do good want to stay in business and keep on, but the North Carolina Fund was different in this respect. Why, and what did George Esser think about this idea of going into a job that was going to end in 5 years?
Well, George knew the job was meant to sunset, and at the end, near the end of the fund, he went to speak to Terry Sanford, and he said, Terry, what do you want to do? And he let Terry Sanford say what he wanted to do, and that was he wanted it to sunset. Sanford had wanted this thing to start up and be a thing of action, not of research, not of delay, but of action. He got a lot of stuff done, and at the end, he wanted it to sunset. But George brilliantly was able to create some new things out of the North Carolina Fund, which was one of which was MDC, which is a North Carolina nonprofit in Chapel Hill that's now alive and kicking and doing very well.
What do they do?
MDC is a spinoff of the fund. They do economic development in the South, and their president is David Dodson. They do some terrific things. Their website is mdc-inc.org, so they do a lot of great things. But George had been dubious about taking the job. It was the stepping out of a probably 10-year, you know, secure job at the NC of government. But it was more interesting to him. And he said later, the fund helped the state move towards integration more than the Institute had. So
he was, a lot of people, this is an interesting kind of thing, and I wonder if George talked about this some with you, but that here in an academic community, there are some people who are very happy with being research and to move things along by helping us understand things better and more completely, and to do the kind of stimulation from the from the academic tower. Mm-hmm. Others say, I want to get out there and play. You know, mm-hmm. I want to go do things. Mm-hmm. And was George of that mind, or did he just take this on as a duty, and he would have just as soon stayed with the Institute and done his service work there?
You know, he was a young man, and he was a brilliant guy with a photographic memory, and he was exactly the kind of guy that, you know, the white elite fellow that would have, you know, risen up to be some sort of high muckety-muck at Chapel Hill. But he was taken with this, and he wanted a challenge, and his ethical code forced him to listen to the people in his staff who would move him to a more radical stance later. And the thing about this fund was, it was an experiment. The problem was, we have too many poor people in the state, and we have a disproportionate number of black poor people. How do we fix that? The mindset was, we're going to experiment. The fund was an experiment, and it was, you know, let's try some new things, you know, buttressed in some research. So that was his mindset. Let's act. Terry wants to act. We're going to act.
A lot of people point out that one of the first great things that happened with respect to the fund was that, some of the North Carolina great foundations early on signed up, and then mm-hmm. the Ford Foundation got interested in this. How did that happen?
Great story. So the fund was financed by the Babcock Foundation, Reynolds Foundation, and the Ford Foundation. Here, again, John Ely, the brilliant idea man for Governor Sanford, said, let's go talk to the New York Foundations about getting some money into the state to fix some of our problems. And Terry Sanford, genius that he was, he went up to the Ford Foundation and he said, you know, we don't want your money. We want your ideas.
You got to watch Terry Sanford when he starts talking like that, don't you? So the Ford Foundation heard the governor say, we don't want your money. And even if they didn't believe him, that kind of turned them on.
We want your idea. And here's in North Carolina, the Southerners didn't go up to the New York foundations like that. They didn't do that. George said that the fellow was thunderstruck.
That's a great
story.
And
he was hooked. And then they started bringing folks down here and flying all over the state. And, you know, at that point, they were involved. And this was the only place, when they did put money into this, North Carolina was the only place in the whole country where the Ford Foundation was putting money into so-called gray area projects or, you know, poverty projects. That was a network of different projects in one state. Everywhere else they did it, it was just one city, Cleveland, Chicago, something like that. So, big deal. It's a big deal to get the Ford to start putting money into the state, because that kept going and going and going, and that has helped make us a leader in our foundation programs and our social progress, I think, in the South also.
What the money came to that, mm-hmm. that enabled the fund to get off to a pretty good start.
Mm-hmm.
But now, what about these ideas that Governor Sanford asked? What ideas and what direction did the Ford Foundation contribute, and how did they work with the ideas that were developing down here in North Carolina?
The Ford Foundation was insistent that whatever the North Carolina Fund do, that it couldn't be discriminating against black folks. And so one of the big projects the fund was developing was a school reform project in North Carolina. And there was a big showdown where the fund almost didn't happen, or almost got disbanded, because the Ford folks were saying, any money we give y'all have got to use it equally for black and white schools. And Eastern North Carolina at that time was so, of course, very segregated. And so Terry Sanford brokered a compromise to let that happen.
Well, Rob, was the push from the Ford Foundation to equalize the support of programs for black and white communities, or was there a push to pull those programs together and try to serve black and whites together?
It was really an anti-poverty thing, and you know they gave money to the fund, and they said, you all work this out, but whatever you do work out is going to have to fly with our principles. So they didn't have they weren't so directed about, you know, black and white equality, but they were directed about poverty alleviation. And they let George have a very free hand. There's another great story about Head Start. You know, Head Start was a big program that would not have been so prevalent in this state except for George Esser and the fund. What happened was, when money from the government started flowing for Head Start, North Carolina ended up having the third most applications from any state for Head Start programs. But that came in the face of a lot of resistance from our state superintendent of schools at the time. And George engineered a switcheroo where George got a call one day from a fellow in Washington. He said, your state has more applications for Head Start than any other state but two in the country. But your governor says he won't take a dime unless it goes through your state superintendent of schools, who is Charlie Carroll. He says, Lyndon Johnson's serious about this. He says, can you, George Esser, can you talk to the governor? So George talked to the governor's, one of his aides, Ed Rankin. And Ed engineered this switcheroo where he found the letter Charlie Carroll had written saying, no money unless it goes through me. He gave George that letter. George got on a plane to Washington, goes to see the head of the OEO. They sit down in a room. That man is named Dr. Richmond. George says, Dr. Richmond, I hear you have a letter from our governor. And Dr. Richmond says, yes, I do. In fact, it happens to be right here. Pulls out a drawer and gives George that letter. And George says, well, I'll take that back, and here's a new one. And the new letter from Rankin didn't say that. So this guy Rankin, this aide to Governor Moore, engineered a whole switcheroo to circumvent Charlie Carroll completely without him even knowing it.
So George Esher, Ed Rankin was one of
He was administration chair of the administration agency under Moore.
Right. It was a really.
You probably know him more than me.
Great. Well, a great guy who was a great diplomat,
and yes,
I'm not sure how he engineered getting the governor's signature on that letter.
I don't know either, but isn't that wily?
It's a great story, and I think it's a tribute to George Esser.
Absolutely.
That he was able to meet with someone like Ed Rankin to say, hey, we've got a problem. How are we going to solve
Absolutely.
It? And let Ed Rankin probably come up with the solution. It's a great.
George was a mild-mannered fellow with huge glasses who was not in the least threatening. He was very smart, but he was so affable and very politically smart.
We're visiting with Rob Bickley about George Esser, Chapel Hill's own George Esser, who passed away a couple of years ago, but before he died, he wrote with Roz Help a memoir of his years with the North Carolina Fund. And all of that is important, and even more important today as we celebrate the publication of another book about the North Carolina Fund called To Right These Wrongs. Rob Bickley and I will be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. We're talking about George Esser, one of Chapel Hill's great citizens who passed away a couple of years ago. A lot of people in Chapel Hill who knew George did not know about the heroic work, important work that he performed back in the 1960s as the director of the North Carolina Fund. Rob Bickley, before George's death, worked with him to prepare a book, what do you call it, an oral history?
An oral history. Mm-hmm.
About the George Esser's years at the North Carolina Fund, 1963 to 1970. Rob, we've been talking about some of the great stories that George told you and that you all put in the book. Interests me in what I'm, and one of the things that I'm curious about, looking back at the 1960s, when we were in the middle of this, maybe the most dramatic social changes that this region's ever gone through, at least in modern times.
Mm-hmm.
And here's a North Carolina Fund that starts out in the context of a government that has been run in North Carolina since 1900, and that is it. I just put it crash that white people run government in North Carolina, and that that if you provide government services, you got to go through the government as it exists. And the North Carolina Fund was committed to providing, I mean, was charged with providing services in a way that would challenge the government operations. Mm-hmm. How did and some of this. Because we were so, back then we were so used to doing things the way we'd always done them, that we were subject to being surprised by having to deal with the situation. Mm-hmm. And George had to figure out a way to do this. Was he surprised? And if so, how did he react to the surprises? And what did the fund do to get through the difficulties and challenges that were caused by the way we did things, the government, mm-hmm. white government, and black, sort of black civil rights revolution going on at the same time.
Well, George told me that at the time the fund started, in the entire state government of this state, not one black person supervised one white person. The only black mm-hmm. folks who had supervisory jobs in the state were black principals or black school officials in the segregated school system. And the fund, one thing it did was it employed black folks, and it employed some of them in a supervisory position to whites. George said that some of the best jobs blacks could get in the whole state were at the North Carolina Fund. So they did a lot to serve as a model that way.
What about the reaction in the white support community for these kind of hiring practices that seem only commonsensical now, but back then were against the code?
Absolutely, very against the code. For instance, when the fund helped set up these 13 community groups all across the state, the fund said, you all have got to have on your board this is for poor people, so you got to have poor white folks and poor black folks on your board. In the mountains, it was poor white farmers. In the eastern part of the state, in the Piedmont, it was poor black folks mainly. Well, that caused a huge furor and a huge reaction against that. And it was very hard, George said, to go against the local people. But, for instance, you know, some of the action agencies just said, we're not going to do that. We're flat out not going to do it. And George and the Ford Foundation had to say, yes, you've got to do it.
You got to do it in order for the money to come to your community, or was that?
Yes, you got to do it for your money, for our money to come to your community action agency in your county or your group of counties. You've got to put some real representatives of the poor community, black or white, on your board, and not just fake representatives who the white folks like, but real representatives. So sometimes that worked, and sometimes that didn't work.
Can you what would happen when it didn't work? What?
Well, when it didn't work, you would have maybe black folks who were just, you know, not going to actually challenge anybody on the board, and they were proud about it, but they didn't actually make any change because the folks who helped them get to that position didn't want them to make any change. In their whole lives, they had not ever been able to make any change. So you'd have people who didn't really do much.
On the other hand, Ra, there were times weren't there when the people who were being served they were strong enough to come in and demand and take charge.
Absolutely,
and to get
right.
get the funds and then begin what in the eyes of the establishment white group were disruptive activities.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And now George had to play a balancing role.
He
to some extent, did he ever find himself saying, "Oh, these people have gone too far. I've got to go down and straighten that out."
Well, he did have to play an in-between role. In Durham is a great example. Operation Breakthrough, you know, Ann Atwater is a local resident. She was one of the folks who would go up there and, you know, and talk to city council and demand decent jobs as clerks and decent housing and relief from slumlords and that kind of thing. And there would be marches on City Hall, and Durham was in a big furor about that. Mayor Grabark was really upset about that. And George got on the hot seat about it, and he had to say, he had to back up Howard Fuller, who was the chief organizer of all this stuff, because Howard was doing it by the book. He was keeping it, you know, nonviolent and principled, and George had to take a stand and back up Howard. And George, critical to George doing that, was the support of his board. Talk about the rich establishment in the state, the tobacco money, you know, Charlie Babcock was on his board, and George used to say that he carried around the Babcock Foundation pocketbook in his wallet, and the Reynolds Foundation pocketbook in the same wallet, in the same pocket. But Charlie Babcock supported George because, and the board did too, because George very carefully kept them informed on everything, and they trusted George. He was their kind of guy, a white, you know, elite background guy who could talk to them, have a cocktail party with them, but he would be straight with them and say, Howard's got to do this. This is the right thing, and they would trust him enough to do it.
And
other times there were big furors, and he got called plenty of other bad names, and there were other, you know, bad times. But in Durham, he did retain their support in the Durham instance, and overall as well.
Was there ever any danger to George in this? Did he ever run into some of the experiences that some of the other people who were active in the 1960s and some of the reform movements found, that they stirred up a reaction that was so strong and in some cases threatening? Did George ever worry about losing his sleep
George
about that?
George never told me that he ever had felt threatened, but there were some physical threats to some folks in the fund. There were some college volunteers down in New Bern, and New Bern didn't like the idea of black and white college students working together and living together down there in the summer. And somebody fired shots into a cabin out there. And then another time, Billy Barnes and Nathan Garrett were on a trip out to the mountains, and forgetting what was going on in the world at that time, I guess they maybe had engrossed in their plans or whatever, but they had dinner together at a little hamburger joint in the mountains, and they got blocked in by all these guys, took their trucks and blocked in their car. And the restaurant owner saw what was happening, and Nathan said it was about to be a lynching. But the cop said, "You guys come with us, we'll get you out of here, y'all get on your way and get out of here." And they got them out of that situation, but that could have been a very bad situation. So there were some really dangerous things that went on, but George himself never felt threatened. He did, though, however, come across Jim Graham, the agriculture commissioner, mm-hmm. in an airport one time. And at that point, the fund had been involved in advocating for a higher minimum wage for farmers, for farm workers. and for other folks, and Jim Graham came up, and he was shaking his fist, and this was a friend of George's. He was a friend. He was so upset. He was shaking his fist, and George actually mimicked shaking his fist when he told me this. And he said, George, we can't afford to do this. These farmers can't afford to pay this more money. And George didn't feel threatened, but it made an impression on him how passionate and almost violent, you know, that feeling was, that you're doing something that's wrong. You're hurting us by making these reforms.
Well, I guess what Commissioner Jim Graham, the Agriculture Commission, who is an old line, you know, wonderful old line,
yes,
North Carolina politician, that this maybe wasn't all about race. This was about economics.
No, it wasn't about race. It was about, it didn't mention race at all. It was all about economics. He was saying, George actually said, I understood. He was saying that the farmers for whom he worked, his constituents, just couldn't afford to pay anymore. But yet their farm workers were, you know, at this dire poverty level.
And this was the nut of the problem that other North Carolinians had, was that the operation of the fund sort of awoke poor people or poor communities, mm-hmm, and had them not only accept the largest, the increased largest that might be available, but mobilize in order to get more things, get their fair share from the government or from other places or from their employers.
That sure did happen, especially in the eastern part of the state. Some community groups banded together and began to get pretty, pretty insistent on their rights, and that upset a lot of people. And also there arose, as a spinoff, that Nathan Garrett headed a black-owned foundation for community development that was very, very powerful and productive in pushing for black folks to help start businesses and that kind of thing. And that, oh boy, that was called, you know, communism. And
now this was a separate organization, but one that was stimulated and maybe funded by the North Carolina Fund.
It was a spinoff of the fund, and George helped persuade the Ford Foundation to fund it. And I don't, so that was a really big deal. George was having to fight accusations of fomenting communism.
Well, listen, we got to take a break. Yeah. We're visiting with Rob Bickley, who worked with George Esser, the late George Esser, on his book, My Years at the North Carolina Fund, 1963 to 1970. We're talking about it all in the context of the publication of a new book about the North Carolina Fund, To Right These Wrongs. Rob Bickley and I'll be right back.
You're listening to Who's Talking on News Talk 1360 WCHL with your host, D.G. Martin. And now, once again, here's D.G.
Welcome back to Who's Talking. This is D.G. Martin. I'm visiting with Rob Bickley, who, with George Esser, wrote George's oral history, My Years at the North Carolina Fund, 1963 to 1970. And there's been a lot of attention focused on the North Carolina Fund and its director, George Esser, as a result of the new book, To Right These Wrongs, published by UNC Press and authored by Duke's professor Robert Korstad and Carolina professor Jim Lalutis. Rob Bickley, we're getting a special inside look and different look at George Esser through your recollections of him. And we talked some about the fun. I'm just curious about, here you are, a young woman, and George Esser is a man in his 80s, and he's I don't want to say he's feeble, but he's just not as strong and vigorous as he once was.
In fact, he
dies soon. What, I mean, you don't think of that generation mix maybe being able to work all that well together. How did Joel, tell us about what it was like to work with him.
Well, George was a terrific guy. He was so civilized, and he was so smart, and he was so gracious. And he was so interesting that I was completely hooked. And just, I would, you know, elicit these stories from George, and my gosh, I would just sit there scribbling furiously. Finally, I got smart and got a tape recorder going. But his passion was so infectious for what he had done. And the same thing was true of Billy Barnes, who was the PR man for the fund forever and is the reason that we can see the pictures of it and see the documentaries about it. And I saw George tell Billy one day, he said, Our lives have been colored by this, colored joyfully, and I wouldn't take anything for it. I would never have changed that experience. So, you know, George really spoke to my heart in terms of helping North Carolina get better, help its people help themselves. And he was so devoted, so passionate. He was absolutely a role model. So I thought it was great fun to be around him. And he did age and come to the end of his life as this was all happening, and I was so acutely conscious that I needed to hurry up and get all this done. His wife died. He had to go on oxygen. He eventually went to the hospital and died. But through it all, he was just determined to get the story down, and we eventually did get it down.
This is a question you might not be prepared to answer, but it just makes me curious because it's clear from what you say that Billy Barnes and George Esser said that these experiences with the North Carolina Fund transformed their lives.
Yes.
But in George's case, was this mountaintop experience one that enabled him to do other things better? And did he go on to do different things so that the experience with the North Carolina Fund was leveraged into other things? Or was it something that he just said, we can never duplicate this experience. This was just, we'll never do this again.
No, it was a peak. It was a peak experience from which there could be no getting higher. And there was just nothing any more as exciting as the fund. And George went to help with the Ford Foundation and the Southern Regional Council, but nothing he could do matched up because the tenor of the times had changed. You know, when George was head of the fund, it was a great social experiment. It was a war on poverty in this country. They say that he coined that phrase. He might object to that, but he was there for the whole war on poverty. The fund actually trained many of the federal war on poverty officials in how to do this. They had been doing it before the Economic Opportunity Act passed, before all that money began flowing like a spigot into the country. So he'd been there beforehand. The Vietnam War came around, and attention turned away from fixing our social problems, or at least grappling with our social problems. Attention turned to Vietnam War protests, and that's what ended this whole era of experimenting to improve our country in terms of social progress. And the time had just passed. You know, when George was there working with the White House, you know, Dick Cheney was a young guy in the Nixon White House in '73. And now look where he is.
Yeah.
No, so George mentioned that, and the time had just changed, and he could never, that kind of opportunity
that
wasn't
thing never
there
came back. Well, that leads me to maybe the last kind of topic that I'd like for you to reflect about, and you do it from a different perspective than the rest of us. In one sense, the North Carolina Fund was a great success in the sense that it brought resources to North Carolina that didn't go to other states, and it mobilized populations of people who had otherwise been unmobilized.
Mm-hmm.
But no conquest of poverty. We still are surrounded by poor people. So how did George feel about this? Did he believe that the North Carolina Fund had been a success, or did he believe that it had been a great war but no success?
You know, George, I'm gonna quote you what George said. George said, obviously we didn't eradicate poverty. We never expected that it could, but we sponsored community action agencies in 11 counties that brought together blacks, whites, wealthy people, poor people, people from government agencies, social workers, preachers. We brought them together for the first time to look at community problems and try to do something about them. We had the radical notion that the poor can control their own destinies. That's what George said.
About that, I'd have to say that looking at the kinds of poverty that we have now, it is not as dire, it is not as just terrible as we saw it documented as the North Carolina Fund began. But it's still there. And poor people, in many respects, seem to be unmobilized and unable to take charge of their lives and to insist on their demands being met. How would George feel about all this?
Well, George, I have two answers to that. Number one, if you look at one of the pictures of Billy Barnes that Billy took, there's a little black boy and in one of the towns of the state, and he's kicking around the dirt in front of this, in this sort of dirt, you know, dirt poor yard of this old dilapidated house, and he's just, you know, we're kind of wearing ragged clothes, and so that's a picture of poverty then, rags and torn down houses and no grass on your yard, nothing to eat. Today, I think that picture is maybe that same kid. Imagine him in a school, sitting there in a classroom where he can't read the assignment, or he's not motivated to go and to learn what's in that social studies lesson that day, because he's just not, he doesn't have the background or the people around him to show him how exciting it is to learn that. Maybe that's today's picture of that kid.
Yeah.
Which is just as bad. You know, it's just as bad to have your mind not be engaged and fed, and your surroundings not be stimulating you in that way. I think what, and George said to me that, you know, the fund gave a lot of poor folks and black folks the opportunity to get jobs, get political office, have a voice. But today, he would say, there's a whole bunch of fields, you know, law enforcement, public health, social services, where you know, it's been a road to the middle class for many black folks and poor folks. But he said, but when they became bureaucrats, they stopped pushing.
Yeah. Well, that's understandable.
He said bureaucrats don't want change, and so that's the sad thing. He said, I couldn't understand that. You go into the DSS in any county, and you'll see a lot of African American faces, but you know, but the bureaucrats are not pushing for change. So that's a sad thing.
Well, I wish we had more time because we're just talking about some of the lessons learned. But there are lessons, and you've helped point them out, and you've just brought us back into those times through your experience with Chapel Hill's own George Esser. And Rob Bakley, we thank you for that, and we remind people about the book that you and George wrote together, My Years at the North Carolina Fund, 1960 through 1970. It's available online and at Amazon. We'll have links to that book on our webpage. Roth, thank you for the book, and thanks for helping us remember George Esser.
Thank you for having me today.
Thanks to all of y'all for listening. This has been Who's Talking with D.G. Martin.